From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Acting Navy Secretary Thomas Modley is apologizing, but it may not save his job. Yesterday, Modley visited the USS Theodore Roosevelt, the carrier ship whose captain he fired for writing a letter asking for help for his COVID-19 infected sailors. In a fiery and invective-laced speech on the ship, Modley referred to the ousted commander, Brett Crozier, as stupid or naive if he thought his letter wouldn't leak to the media. Well, now Modley is apologizing for calling Crozier stupid. Crozier's been fired but was cheered by his crew as he left the ship. Crozier himself now has COVID-19, and President Trump's indicated he might get involved. Let's bring in NPR's Tom Bowman, who's at the Pentagon. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Robin.
And tell us more about this apology and also this speech, which, of course, interestingly enough, was also leaked to the media.
Right. The audio was leaked, and Secretary Modley was pretty defensive, and he told the crew that he and Navy leaders were working to help Captain Crozier deal with the virus before that alarming letter calling for more help was written. Modley said in his speech, and you mentioned this, that the captain was either, quote, too naive or too stupid to be the commanding officer of a ship like this. The alternative is that he did it on purpose, and that's a serious violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Now, after that, Modley put out a statement saying he was speaking from the heart, and he stands by every word.
Yeah.
Then last night, Robin, he put out another statement saying he apologized, adding, quote, let me be clear, I do not think Captain Brett Crozier is naive nor stupid. I think and always believed him to be the opposite.
Well, a number of Democratic members in the House Armed Services Committee want more. They're calling for Modley's resignation. So what's likely to happen, and what does this mean for the Navy right now?
Well, for Modley, we don't know. We know that we don't know if he'll resign or not. Most of the focus now, of course, is on coronavirus. And it's important to note that Modley is acting secretary. There's another nominee for his position. President Trump last month officially nominated Kenneth Braithwaite, his current ambassador to Norway, to serve as Secretary of the Navy. Braithwaite is a retired Rear Admiral and has served as ambassador to Norway since February of 2018.
Yeah. Well, President Trump weighed in on Captain Crozier's firing yesterday at a briefing. Let's listen.
So the letter shouldn't have been sent. With all of that said, his career prior to that was very good. So I'm going to get involved and see exactly what's going on there, because I don't want to destroy somebody for having a bad day.
Tom, how unusual would it be for the White House, a White House, to weigh in like this? Or maybe, you know, it would seem impossible that this president would allow a firestorm like this to keep burning.
Well, it's pretty unusual because as commander-in-chief, this case could end up on his desk. There's an ongoing investigation into Crozier's letter and what happened. So for the president to get involved and criticize the captain for sending that letter could raise an issue of what's called undue command influence, meaning a senior officer or official overseeing a case who weighs in for or against someone could obviously prejudice the case, and it could get thrown out. That's why Defense Secretary Mark Esperser has said several times he does not want to comment on the case because it could end up on his desk.
Yeah. Well, and what about Captain Crozier? Again, he's tested positive for the coronavirus. Do we know how he is?
Well, it was reported that those who know him say Crozier tested positive, but Crozier, through Navy officials, said he didn't want to talk at all about this.
Yeah. And what about the sailors on the carrier? How's their health?
Well, the carrier is still on Guam. Sailors are still being tested. 79% of the crew has been tested. 230 tested positive. No one is in the hospital. But obviously, Robin, those numbers will continue to go up.
Yeah. And what about what some would say is a bigger issue here? Captain Crozier was fired for writing the letter, but it would imply that he had no other channels to try to get help for infected sailors. So are there concerns that the Navy isn't doing enough?
Well, you do hear a bit about that in social media. I haven't heard from any individual sailors, but the positive reception that Captain Crozier got from the crew indicates they were happy he was trying to do more to help. They clearly thought more had to be done.
Yeah.
The challenge is, if you're on a carrier, an aircraft or a submarine, you're in pretty close quarters. So the Navy and all the services this week have said, if you can't maintain that required 6-foot distance, you have to wear a mask. But there are reports of additional cases on other ships, including at least one now on the hospital ship Comfort, now up in New York. Obviously, again, these cases will continue to rise.
NPR's Tom Bowman out doing his hard work at the Pentagon. Tom, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
To Britain now, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson remains in intensive care after his coronavirus symptoms worsened yesterday. The 55-year-old leader had been quarantined in his Downing Street residence before that. He was diagnosed with COVID-19 late last month. The BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson joins us now via Skype. And Rob, this is obviously very serious. What can you tell us about the Prime Minister's condition right now?
So let me give you the latest, and that is that the Prime Minister is still in intensive care, but he has not got pneumonia, according to a Downing Street spokesman. He is receiving standard oxygen treatment, but that means that he's not plugged up to one of these ventilating machines. We understand that he is conscious, and that he is stable and in good spirits. Now, I know all that sounds pretty grave, but I think compared to the news last night in London, this comes as a positive relief, because I understand that government ministers and officials at Downing Street were genuinely shocked when Mr. Johnson was moved from being in a regular hospital bed to intensive care. So, if you like, yeah, Still immensely serious, but compared to where we were, a sense of relief.
But Rob, there's also something else. Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove is now self-isolating. We're hearing at home because a family member is showing mild symptoms. He says he's not showing any signs of the illness. He spoke to the BBC today. Let's listen.
We must all follow the appropriate medical advice. And all of us are discovering that this virus has a malignity, a malevolence that is truly frightening.
It is truly frightening. I mean, he says he's working from home now, but who's in charge right now of the British government?
I'll come to who's in charge in a second, but I want to get to the frightening part first, Tanya. I say that because, of course, like a lot of other countries which have had lockdowns, it's been surreal, it's been unreal. The moment at which I think the country heard the Prime Minister had not only been hospitalized but gone into intensive care, I think it reached a new level of sort of fear. But actually, many people in government have been stricken by the virus. And the reason I mention that and the sort of change in mood over Mr. Johnson's hospitalization is that, if you think about it, it's Mr. Johnson, it's the government that's supposed to be protecting us, the rest of us, mm-hmm, in the country from this virus. So to have them go down with it, I think that shows you how abnormal things are. Now, to briefly answer your question, we have a cabinet system. We don't have a presidential system. And of course, there's a large bureaucracy, which we call the civil service, the permanent officials out there. But be in no doubt, now, this is a government that has taken a severe hit in real terms and in sort of presentational and governance terms too.
Speaking about the political landscape, the opposition Labour Party elected a new leader over the weekend. Tell us more about that. It seems that election could be taking an added significance right now.
It's hugely important for this reason, that in many ways, Britain's system requires, it's a very oppositional system, it's an adversarial system. It very much requires the opposition to be providing a forensic critique of the government. And Jeremy Corbyn hasn't really been doing that. He's just not provided much in the way of opposition to either Mr. Johnson's government or before that Theresa May. And in many ways, I know this sort of sounds almost like a golden era, that the sort of Brexit crisis era. Part of the dysfunctionality of that period was not only that the governing Conservative Party was very divided over Brexit, but the opposition Labour Party was just absent. So in many ways, the election of Sir Keir Starmer as the leader of that party, a man who's much more of an establishment figure, who doesn't have that sort of anti-Western, anti-capitalist baggage that Jeremy Corbyn has. I think in a few months, in a few years, people will look back and say, aha, that was the kind of point where, amidst the craziness and madness of the virus, Britain sort of started to go back to normal.
You mentioned
just the reaction from so many folks within government, either showing symptoms or testing positive for COVID-19. Give us a sense of what it is like where you are right now. The number of coronavirus cases in the UK continues to rise.
There's a sense that Britain hasn't turned the corner yet, that this is still immensely serious, that we haven't reached the peak, but that at least the numbers aren't going up as fast as might have been feared or expected.
That's BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. Rob, as always, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and be well, everybody.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Some 10 million people have filed for unemployment because of the coronavirus, and the real number of people who have lost their jobs or had their hours cut is probably much higher and is expected to keep growing. Meanwhile, people who are trying to file for unemployment have been plagued by crashing websites and busy phone lines. For more on how to navigate all of this, we have Andrew Stettner, a senior fellow at the progressive nonpartisan think tank, the Century Foundation. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
And Andrew, let's start by laying out briefly who can actually file for unemployment right now under ordinary unemployment and the CARES Act that Congress recently passed.
So normally unemployment is available to workers that get a paycheck, like a W-2, and they can been on the job for at least 6 months. And they are unemployed through no fault of their own, including individuals who may still be connected to their job, but just have 0 hours in a week. So the new program realizes that that misses a lot of people, whether it be those who are self-employed or working through apps in the gig economy, or those who are newer to their jobs. If those individuals are unemployed because of COVID-19, Congress has given them a new special benefit through the end of this year.
Can you explain for us, though, for someone who has been furloughed, for instance, instead of laid off or fired, can they file for unemployment?
Thanks for that question, because there's a lot of confusion about that. But if you're furloughed, or even if you've just been cut way back in your hours, you can collect unemployment. Indeed, since 1935, when the law was passed, factories every year close down, particularly in the summer, and their workers collect benefits and then go back to work when they get back into motion. That's the same thing that's happening to many workers in retail, hotels, and all across the economy today.
What kind of benefits should people actually expect to get, and how much does it vary state by state?
There's a lot of variance state by state. Typically, it's half of your prior paycheck up to a maximum as low as $250 or as high as approaching $1,000 per week in benefits. But the really good news is that Congress over the next 4 months is going to bump up everybody's benefit by $600 per week. So most workers should be expecting basically to maintain their pay over the next 4 months.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that enrollment, because we're hearing from folks all over the country who are now facing all kinds of issues just trying to file in the first place. They can't get in. The phone lines are busy or the websites are crashing.
You know, when you see that creaky car on the road with some rust around the tires, that was the unemployment system going into this crisis. And now everybody in America is trying to jump into that vehicle. Many of the systems are using 1970s or 1980s technology, and even many of the newer websites are having troubles. So my advice is just to be very persistent. Mm. We've talked to people in New York. Some have had to call literally hundreds, maybe thousands of times. You're just going to have to be persistent. Try different times of the day and have everything ready before you start your online or phone application, your name, your social security number, all that information ready.
Yeah, so those are some of the basic things that you need. But what else do you need?
You'd want to have your work history. You know, if you're self-employed, you know, have your tax return or your Schedule C or some other evidence, you know, handy. If you're a regular worker, grab your W-2 and your pay stubs. Gather up any letter or communication by email or text that you got from your employer on your last day. And before you open your online application, spend some time just reading the websites. I will commend states for putting out some pretty good information about the process and how to answer some of the tricky questions on the application. So spend some time with the instructions.
Using your example of the systems being kind of like an old rusty car that we see out on the road, what do states need to be thinking about as they design their systems to let people file for unemployment? This doesn't look like an issue that's going away anytime soon. People continue to file for unemployment every single day or are trying to. And these are really huge and unusual numbers of folks who just can't get through.
So I think in the immediate term, they need to increase their bandwidth. We recommend that they take a triage approach, train people quickly on some of the simple issues like resetting your password, and then leave the more tricky stuff to seasoned employees. We don't think it's too late to make changes to their systems. For example, translating more of the pages into Spanish and other languages, and make it easier to file these applications on your phone. Unfortunately, when they've designed these systems, they don't take a customer-centered approach generally. Understand your customers and the challenges that they have. You know, for example, speaking another language or not having a computer at home.
One last question for you. You talked about the CARES Act. Do you think that the CARES Act goes far enough in providing protections for unemployed folks and also the money that they need?
I think in general, we think it's probably too short of a dose of action. You know, we think this is going to trigger a recession, and many workers and sectors, unfortunately, will not be able to go back to their same jobs because some of the companies won't make it through. And so they'll have to have a longer period looking for a new job. So we want a longer period of assistance. We want some fixes to the underlying program. And we are really calling on the Labor Department to interpret the CARES Act in a very expansive way, making sure that these new benefits are really delivered to the gig workers and others who are left out of unemployment benefits typically.
That's Andrew Stettner with the progressive think tank, the Century Foundation. Andrew, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
So, have you been Zoom bombed? Security concerns have been piling up about Zoom, the video conferencing app that's scrambling to accommodate new users in the pandemic. New York City's school district is advising teachers not to use it to connect with kids. AA groups and Muslim clerics meeting online have been mocked and terrorized. And federal prosecutors have issued a warning to Zoom bombers gathering on sites like Reddit and 4chan to coordinate attacks. Some may be just teens trying to upend online schooling, others far more dangerous. Ina Fried is chief technology correspondent for Axios. Ina, so someone gets your password and they're in. How big is this?
You know, it's a pretty big growing pain for this company that historically has hosted business meetings and all of a sudden finds itself what people are using, as you say, everything from AA meetings to school classes to just chats for friends trying to stay in touch. So it's a big deal.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to speak your language here for a second. People have raised alarms that Zoom doesn't have end-to-end encryption for all calls, despite its marketing. Explain what that means and why it's a problem.
So, I mean, in general, people like their conversations to stay between them. Seems pretty simple. One of the best ways to do that is to have it encrypted from end to end. One of the challenges that Zoom encountered is that it works both over the internet, which is fairly easy to encrypt if that's what you want to do, as well as phone calls, which are harder to encrypt. So people can dial into Zoom from their regular phone, from a cell phone, or they can call in over the internet. So it turned out that depending on who was on the call, how encrypted it was.
Well, so, you know, there are other problems, too. A software developer found that Zoom's Mac app could turn on someone's camera without permission. What can people do to make sure, first of all, they're not hacked, somebody doesn't get in and do some of these disgusting things we're hearing about, you know, writing epithets across the screen, or that their information isn't taken or their technology isn't used? What can people do?
So there's two really good options, both of which will solve the problem. One that some people are doing is just switching to a different service. So Microsoft Teams or Skype or Slack or different programs. But the other is you really can protect yourself by changing the settings so that it requires a password, so that the administrator has to allow people in so that they can check and make sure it's the participants that are supposed to be there.
Yeah. And what is Zoom saying about this? Because we know the University of Toronto just last week discovered Zoom's been routing some of its calls through China. Zoom apologized for that, but now there's concern that the Chinese government could have access to the content of any of these calls. So what is Zoom saying about what it's doing to protect users?
So Zoom has apologized for several things. It's apologized for how it described encryption, for not being fully accurate. It said that it was an error in managing capacity that allowed some calls to be routed through China. In general, it tries to do the calls in the location where the call is taking place. Sometimes when it gets busy, it sends it to another region, but it tries never to do it in China because China has different requirements and the government could listen. In some cases, during the peak of things, calls did get routed through China. Zoom has apologized for that and said it won't do that going forward.
And Ina, just the most basic question, why can't, you know, I've been to Zoom funerals, you know, Zoom meetings. Can't the organizer just kick somebody out when they hack in?
Well, they can if they have the settings right. So, again, the key is to have an active administrator that's overseeing things.
Yeah, and knows what they're doing. Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent at Axios, on problems at Zoom, which many of us are now becoming familiar with. Ina, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And while millions of Americans are struggling to pay rent and mortgages, one class of investors stands to make it big: real estate investors, who bought up many distressed assets when the market bottomed out back in 2008. They say, well, no one likes to profit off someone else's misfortune. Many of them see the chance of a decade, and they have cash. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure at member station VPM. Robin, this sounds so cruel, you know. These guys sound like vultures. But there are winners and losers in every financial crisis. So tell us why they're, I don't know if vultures have chops, but tell us why they're licking their chops.
Vultures, they would always say that they're necessary parts of the ecosystem. They have to clean up and accelerate the whole life cycle process. And here there's true pain and distress and an inability to pay rents across, you know, we've seen it in commercial real estate with barren malls and shopping centers doing a fraction of their normal business. And everyone is also closely watching residential real estate. So to the extent that this brings many assets to market at thick discounts to where they were trading just a month ago, vulture investors are obviously salivating.
Well, are there signs that this is already happening?
It's still early, but you're starting to see cracks. If you look at the number of high-profile tenants publicly revealing that they can't or won't make rent in malls, I mean, Cheesecake Factory comes to mind. We saw in the Wall Street Journal that the Royal Bank of Canada seized $600 million in mortgage debt from clients. There's a Florida vulture investment shop that bought $10 million in loans from a bank for about $7.4 million. So the juices are starting to flow, if you will.
Yeah, this is a huge profit margin in something like this.
Yeah, I mean, imagine the dream scenario. If you're a vulture investor, you swoop in, you buy a distressed asset or a bunch of loans from banks at a 25% or more discount. And then ideally, you would flip them at a quick premium to a more long-term investor with billions to spend. And there is a stat that there's about $142 billion in dry powder, which is fresh money that enormous institutions like Blackstone and Fortress and Brookfield have to spend on real estate. So people are going to be champing.
What about the average, you know, person? Just, you know, maybe somebody saying, well, gee, maybe, you know, I feel badly if somebody can't make their rent or mortgage, but would this be a good time for me to house hunt?
Well, people keep looking at residential real estate, which has had an epic comeback since the Great Recession. And there's much speculation and froth, Robin, that's still embedded in rich prices. But you are starting to see bids being more tentative, and people who are increasingly on the fence about listing in a frozen market. We saw the volume of mortgage applications for loans used to purchase new homes was down 24% compared with a year ago. And it's kind of refinance that has taken over the entire category. So if this keeps up, you're going to see people step up and accept lower bids on their homes.
Yeah. And just briefly, it was a booming economy. We saw these high-rise condos going up everywhere. What's happened to that unfinished construction?
Yeah, I'm thinking of Miami,
yeah.
My hometown, where, you know, they said in 2008, the idled construction crane became the state bird. So there are going to be more and more cases where banks behind these properties think that it's just time to fish or cut bait. And so there's already an unfinished Manhattan luxury condo on the distressed market. Don't forget, a lot of times it's the banks and the loans that they sell down market that make these decisions.
Yeah. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure at member station VPM. Robin, thank you so much. We had so many birds in this. Cranes, vultures.
Robins.
And me. And you. Yes.
Thank you so much.
It's here
Take
now.
Care.
And let's turn to Wisconsin, where despite a stay-at-home order, today's election is still going forward. The governor had ordered the election postponed, but he was overruled late yesterday by the state Supreme Court. Laurel White is state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. And Laurel, we know that thousands of poll workers have decided not to work. The National Guard has now stepped in to help run this election. What's happening at the polls?
Well, we're hearing about some pretty long wait times at polls across the state. In Milwaukee in particular, folks are waiting about 2 hours. It's pretty remarkable in Milwaukee in particular because of that poll worker shortage. They've actually limited polling places to just 5 sites for the entire city. Normally, they have 180 sites. So understandable that they've got some lines there. We're hearing from voters that they're pretty frustrated by that.
Yeah, with these long lines, are any measures being taken to make certain people are safe from getting infected?
Absolutely. Voters are being encouraged to practice social distancing. I've seen some polling places that actually have 6 feet marked out with orange traffic cones to make sure that people are standing as far apart as they need to.
Yeah, you know, what is the impact of this chaos? I mean, what's expected to how this will play out with the election, and when will we know the results?
Well, we've been asking election officials across the state for days now how turnout might be affected by all of this, and they really don't know. It comes down to a pretty complicated calculus between, you know, voters deciding whether they want to go out into the world and kind of take that risk of exposure to the virus, if voting is that important to them. There have been some folks who haven't gotten absentee mail-in ballots that they've requested, so those individuals are having to make that choice today when they really wanted to vote by mail instead. So we'll have to wait and see. Wisconsin, as I'm sure you've heard, has some pretty close elections, so the matter of turnout here is one that we really take seriously and watch very closely. When elections are decided by just, you know, 5,000 votes for our last state Supreme Court race, for example, it really makes a big difference.
That's Laurel White. She is state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you, Laurel, for joining us.
Absolutely.
Well, across the country, black and brown people are disproportionately contracting and dying from COVID-19. In Chicago, 70% of those who have died are black, a pattern we're seeing in places like Detroit, New Orleans, and Milwaukee. And in New York City, the hardest hit areas are in the Bronx, Brooklyn, and Queens, largely black and Latino neighborhoods. For more on this, we're joined now by Dr. Uche Blackstock. She's an urgent care doctor for clinics in Brooklyn and founder of Advancing Health Equity. And doctor, I know that you have been very busy and your clinic, so we appreciate you taking the time. But first off, can you tell us more about the people coming into your clinics for care?
Sure. Over the last few weeks, we've definitely noticed sicker and sicker patients. Typically in urgent care, we see patients presenting with pretty simple complaints, sore throat, a cut on the leg, but we've been seeing patients complaining of shortness of breath and chest tightness. And in the areas I work in central Brooklyn, I've noticed definitely a demographic change in who we're seeing. We're seeing more Black and brown patients. We're seeing a lot of people who are essential workers who work for the city, for the police department, or the MTA, the subway and bus system. And we're seeing a lot of service workers as well.
COVID-19, of course, does not discriminate. We're all equally susceptible. But it's not, as some say, a societal equalizer. You've already seen evidence that this pandemic is impacting Black and Latino communities, as you mentioned, who you're seeing coming in this clinic. But there are also other things. The ability to get tested is one.
Absolutely. And even when the initial testing criteria came out from the CDC, it required that a patient had visited one of the areas where COVID-19 was endemic, so China or Italy, or required you to have known someone who had tested positive or been close to them. And we knew very early on that really excluded a lot of patients, especially low-income patients. And what we're slowly finding out is that coronavirus had been circulating in those communities for weeks, but had gone undetected because they weren't being tested.
You argue that in addition to implicit bias within medicine, this health crisis is about structural racism. Can you say more about why we're seeing hot zones in predominantly Black and brown communities in New York and beyond?
So absolutely. So we know, and there is tons of data to support this, that we have pre-existing racialized health disparities. So Black patients often have the highest rates of obesity, asthma, hypertension, diabetes. Those are all actually risk factors for developing serious complications of COVID-19. And the reasons why that population has high rates of those chronic diseases is that a result of lack of access to care. Black people have some of the highest uninsurance rates. Also, just lack of quality, receiving quality care. The hospitals in minority neighborhoods have been well documented to provide lower quality care. And then also patients have to, when they interface with the healthcare system, often Black and brown patients must face implicit bias on the part of providers. So there's so many layers that are contributing to these inequities that we're seeing.
Doctor, you know, as you're stating right now, this isn't just a New York story. We're seeing it in Milwaukee, in Detroit, in Chicago. You know, but still the CDC, which normally tracks pandemics through age and location and race, they've not been publicly tracking race in this instance. Congressional Democrats have asked Health and Human Services to publicly release this data. What are your thoughts on this?
Oh, no, definitely. This is absolutely mandatory. We are in unprecedented times. We are in essentially a crisis. And we already see from the preliminary data in some of the locations that you mentioned that Black people are overrepresented in terms of the COVID-19 cases and mortality. And so it would behoove all of the state's Department of Health to release this data immediately. The reason why it's important is because we need to know how do we equitably allocate healthcare resources. So communities need more healthcare workers, right? Which communities need more ventilators? And that will enable us really to be able to care for each community in an equitable fashion.
If you are a person of color, how can you advocate for your health? If you're hearing this, if you've experienced it yourself where you've gone to try to get a test and you can't, what are some recommendations from you?
So that's such an important question. I always say to bring a family member or a close friend with you just to help advocate on your part. And so now we do know that with the pandemic, visitors are not often allowed in urgent cares or in the emergency department with patients. And so we have technology so we can have, you can have loved ones call and speak to the doctors on your behalf if you're not feeling well. So that's super important. Another thing is just to try to learn as much as possible about what's going on with this disease, know about the symptoms so that you can advocate for yourself. And I will also say, you know, definitely there is only so much that as a patient that you can do. Definitely, as I mentioned before, there are structural barriers, but at least you have those tools in your pocket to help advocate on your behalf.
I'm thinking about you. You're on the front lines. You have known, as you said, we've known for a long time about how structural racism impacts the health of people of color. You're a Black woman. How are you doing through all of this as you go to the clinic day in and day out?
I will admit this is probably one of the most difficult experiences of my career. I mean, I even have some mentors who've been practicing emergency medicine for 35 plus years, and they said they've never seen anything like this. For the first time ever, I have fear about going to work because I obviously don't want to catch coronavirus. I don't want to bring it home to my family. I have two small children, and so I have concerns about that. I have concerns about my loved ones, and I have concerns about my patients, just seeing my patients suffer and to know that a lot of the suffering was largely preventable is incredibly painful. So, you know, I'm just trying to take each day at a time and trying to find the silver lining in this crisis right now.
That's Dr. Uche Blackstock, clinical doctor in Brooklyn and founder of Advancing Health Equity. Thank you for your work.
Thank you for having me.
So where are we? Well, COVID-19 has killed more than 11,000 people in the U.S. The number of confirmed cases in this country has passed 378,000. Worldwide, the death toll is more than 76,000, the largest share in Italy, where more than 16,500 people have died. Norway's prime minister said today that the country will begin to lift some of the restrictions imposed to prevent the spread of the virus. That's something U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams told ABC's Good Morning America he's hoping for.
But I want the American people to know there is a light at the end of this tunnel, and we feel confident that if we keep doing the right thing for the rest of this month, that we can start to slowly reopen in some places.
But before that can happen, scientists need to learn more about the coronavirus and how they might develop an effective vaccine. And for that, there's research going on around the country, as Ray Ellen Bichelle of the Mountain West News Bureau has been finding out.
Sometime around Valentine's Day, a box arrived at a lab in Fort Collins, Colorado. It contained vials full of coronavirus, just what Lindsay Hartson and her colleagues had been waiting for.
Yes, we were really excited.
They started growing the virus first. Then, once there was enough of it to work with, Hartson got to business experimenting with different ways of killing it.
Yeah, we found that using the techniques that we're using in the lab, we've been really successful at inactivating the virus.
Hartson is a lab manager at Colorado State University's Infectious Disease Research Center, and she's doing this work because a killed virus is the key ingredient in the COVID-19 vaccine they're trying to make. The idea is that the killed virus would act like a wanted poster for the immune system, basically saying it looks like this size, this shape, and it's dangerous.
If we don't have it exactly, we're very close.
But in order to make a good wanted poster, you have to kill the virus the right way. You can't completely obliterate it. It still needs to look like the virus that causes COVID-19. Hartson's weapons of choice for killing the virus the right way sound ridiculously simple: vitamins and light. To be specific, she puts the virus in a plastic bag, squirts in some vitamin B2, also known as riboflavin.
If you take a vitamin supplement or a daily supplement, you're likely taking some riboflavin into your diet.
And then she slides the bag into what looks like a copy machine to give it a dose of UV light equivalent to about 1/4 of a second in a tanning bed.
The actual light treatment itself takes less than a minute, which is fantastic. It's pretty quick.
The combination of vitamin B2 plus UV light ruins the virus's genetic material, so it can't multiply.
Really, the next big step is, does this induce an immune response? You know, we're very confident in our ability to inactivate the virus and produce that end of the vaccine. Now the question is, will it do what we wanted to do in an in vivo model?
In this case, the term in vivo model is a fancy way of saying hamsters. Hartson's colleagues in another lab in Colorado are now trying to figure out if the virus she killed actually protects hamsters from a live version of the virus. Ray Goodrich is the executive director of the Infectious Disease Research Center at Colorado State University. He says they expect to know by the end of this month if it's working or not.
The step in parallel that we'll be running is, how do we scale this up?
Now, this is just one option for a potential vaccine. For example, researchers in Seattle came up with a potential vaccine using a different approach, and they've already started testing to see if it's safe in people. Goodrich says that's fine.
When you have a problem of this magnitude, attacking it from every possible angle that you can is wise.
Meanwhile, in a small town called Hamilton, Montana, scientists with the National Institutes of Health are also working hard on COVID-19.
My name is Emmy DeWitt.
I'm Vincent Munster.
They work at a place called Rocky Mountain Laboratories, and they aren't offering any interviews at the moment because they're slammed with COVID work. So I dug up some recordings I made when I visited the place back in 2016, when they'd been studying all kinds of nasty viruses.
Influenza A viruses, seasonal flu, pandemic flu, avian flu, and 1918 flu, Nipah virus, Ebola virus, PRRS, P-R-R-S-V, which is a pig virus. Then there's MERS coronavirus.
And now the virus that causes COVID-19. On that visit 4 years ago, they showed me what it was like to do this kind of work. For really deadly viruses like Ebola, they take these suits off a rack. They look like floppy plastic space suits with rubber boots attached. They attach an air hose so they don't breathe in anything bad and zip themselves inside.
You're in your own little bubble doing your own thing.
They usually use a simpler getup for studying COVID-19, though animal studies will sometimes take place in the high biosafety lab. In any case, they've been busy. They already figured out how the virus invades human cells and are among the scientists who came out with the study that found that the new coronavirus can stick around on plastic and steel for up to 2 or 3 days. Now on their long to-do list, test the efficacy of future vaccines. For Here and Now, I'm Raylan Bishel.
So as we're hearing, there's lots of work being done, but there's lots of reasons to do it. We're reminded, Tanya, today, New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo announced the deadliest day in the coronavirus outbreak, with the highest increase from the day before. As of today, he said 5,489 New Yorkers had lost their lives to COVID-19, up from 4,758 a day earlier. Again, that's the biggest increase over the day before. So lots of work yet to do. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.